You can't take the top rate up. You just can't. What do you mean? You're a Republican, explained Cohn, who was a Democrat. Republicans were always for lower personal income tax rates. Republicans were the party of Reagan, who had lowered the top federal income tax rate from 70% to 28%. You will get absolutely destroyed if you take the top rate up. Trump seemed to understand. Cohn had a packet of Goldman Sachs-style charts and tables to educate the president on taxes. Trump was not interested and did not read it. At a meeting in the Oval Office, Trump wanted to know what the new individual income tax rates would be. "I like these big round numbers," he said. 10%, 20%, 25%. Good solid numbers that would be easy to sell. Mnuchin, Cohn, and Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney said there needed to be analysis, study, and discussion on the impact on revenue, the deficit, and the relation to expected federal spending. "I want to know what the numbers are going to be," Trump said, throwing out numbers again. "I think they ought to be 10, 20, and 25. He dismissed any effort to crunch the numbers. A small change in rates could have a surprising impact on taxes collected by the U.S. Treasury. "I don't care about any of that," Trump said. Solid, round numbers were key. "That's what people can understand," he said. "That's how I'm going to sell it." The central feature of Cohn's tax reform packet was on the first page. Increasing economic growth from 2% to 3% would create $3 trillion in budget savings over 10 years. "Sir, if we can get from 2 to 3%, that's all we've got to do. We could pay for the tax plan," Cohn said. The more economic growth, the more taxes the government would collect. Simple in theory, but it would be hard, perhaps impossible, to get 3% growth, often a Republican fantasy. Trump liked the idea. He was infatuated with the simplicity and started using variations of high economic growth in speeches. Cohn tried to explain that during the Reagan era, the U.S. economy had been very competitive and other countries had begun cutting their taxes. There was plenty of history and technical detail. "I don't give a shit about that," Trump said. On Monday nights, Speaker Paul Ryan hosted an Italian buffet in his conference room for the six main tax reform players representing Congress and the administration. Known as the Big Six, they were Ryan, McConnell, House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady, Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee Orrin Hatch, Mnuchin, and Cohn. The group was a Democrat's nightmare. Five conservative Republicans and the former president of Goldman Sachs revising the tax code. The group came up with four principles: simplification of the tax code, tax relief for middle-income families, job creation and wage growth, and bringing back and taxing the trillions of corporate dollars stashed overseas. Cohn's approach to the congressional leadership was to treat them like gold. In his decades in the client service business at Goldman, everyone was treated as the most important client. He had told his clients there, "I'm available 24/7. You want to talk? We talk." The customer was always first, and only the customer counted. Now the congressional leadership was, for the moment, the only customer. Mnuchin had alienated some Republican House members early on in the administration by insisting they had to vote for certain continuing budget resolutions and for the debt ceiling, the limit on how much the government could borrow. OMB Director Mick Mulvaney, who had served 6 years in the House, reported to Cohn that one Republican told Mnuchin, "Mr. Secretary, the last time someone told me what I had to do, I was 18. It was my dad, and I never listened to him again either." Later, Mnuchin proposed capping the amount of business income a taxpayer could pay at the lower personal income tax rates, known as pass-throughs. He said some 95% of the pass-through tax returns were below $350,000 in annual income. "No," Ryan and Brady said. That was the dumbest idea they had ever heard. Mnuchin had not accounted for the other 5% of pass-through tax returns, which included huge mega-donors to the Republican Party like the Koch brothers. Mnuchin went behind Ryan's and Brady's backs to try to enlist some House Republicans. Mulvaney threw a note on Cohn's desk. If you want to get tax reform done, keep Mnuchin out of the Capitol. Cohn reported this to Kelly. As the tax negotiations intensified in November, Mnuchin went on a tour of the country, speaking and selling the tax plan alongside Ivanka in California on November 5th and 6th, and New Jersey on November 13th, and on his own in Ohio on November 14th. On the Senate side, Finance Committee Chair Orrin Hatch put together a group made up of Senators Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, Rob Portman of Ohio, Tim Scott of South Carolina, and John Thune of South Dakota to handle the negotiations on his behalf, since he had a relatively limited knowledge of tax policy. Cohn was on the phone nonstop with these senators. Cohn discovered how challenging tax reform could be. One of his charts was titled, "The Federal Income Tax System is Very Progressive." He believed it was another important chart. It showed the big picture, told the whole story. 44% of Americans did not pay federal income tax. During the 2012 presidential campaign, when the percentage was higher immediately following the Great Recession, Republican nominee Mitt Romney was recorded saying disparagingly, "There are 47% who are with President Barack Obama, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it, that that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them, and they will vote for this president no matter what. These are people who pay no income tax. My job is not to worry about those people. I'll never convince them they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives." While most of the 44% paid payroll taxes on their wages that went toward Social Security and Medicare, as well as state, local, property, and sales taxes, they paid $0 in federal income tax. That meant the federal government brought in revenue from its budget from only 56%. Many low-income people paid less than zero, Cohn's slide showed. Their income was so low that not only did they owe the government no federal income tax, they cost the federal government revenue because it gave them refundable tax credits, money from the government like the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit. Ivanka Trump worked with Senators Marco Rubio and Mike Lee to increase the child tax credit from up to $1,000 per child to $2,000. Rubio and Lee would not vote for the final tax package unless this was included. "We had to buy their votes," Cohn said. "We'd been extorted by Lee and Rubio." He believed the federal government had conflated taxes and welfare and, of course, was using tax legislation to help the poor. The corporate tax rate was still a key question. Trump was stuck on 15%. Cohn and Mnuchin finally got him to agree to 18%. Then Speaker Ryan, the tax expert, called and urged Trump to move to 20%. Orrin Hatch's group of senators and Cohn came up with a rate of 21%. Cohn called Trump. He gave the president a complicated technical description of the advantages of this corporate tax rate. A tax lawyer might understand the nuances of the various percentages or of certain loopholes. Trump could not possibly understand or care about it. "Go for it," Trump said. Cohn saw that he could do anything on the tax reform bill as long as Trump could call it a win. Trump had a marketing idea. Call it the Cut, Cut, Cut Bill. He loved the idea and had a long phone call with Ryan and Brady to sell this name. After the phone call, Trump was under the impression that it would be called the Cut, Cut, Cut Bill in the House. The House called it the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. But because of ancient Senate rules, that title was too short, and rather unbelievably it was finalized as an act to provide for reconciliation pursuant to Titles 2 and 5 of the concurrent resolution on the budget for fiscal year 2018. Cohn found out that getting votes in the Senate was all about giving individual senators their favorite loopholes or tax breaks. "It's a candy store," he said. Senators Chuck Grassley, John Thune, and Dean Heller were among those who wanted credits for alternative fuel, including windmills. Susan Collins insisted on a deduction for school teachers who bought supplies for their classrooms. She would not vote for the bill if the deduction was not included. Ron Johnson of Wisconsin was concerned about pass-through businesses. McConnell made other promises, including one to Jeff Flake on immigration. The final bill was a dizzying labyrinth of numbers, rules, and categories. There was no doubt that it was a Republican tax bill, benefiting corporations and the wealthy most. The bill, however, would reduce taxes for all income groups in 2018, and according to the Tax Policy Center, after-tax income would go up an average of 2.2%. Most in the middle class, Americans earning taxable income ranging from $19,000 to $77,000, would go from the 15% tax bracket to the new lower 12% tax bracket, saving the average person hundreds of dollars. These individual tax cuts, however, would decrease each year and end altogether in 2025. The business benefits included the reduction in the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. Another was that so-called pass-through enterprises, such as partnerships and small businesses like the Trump Organization, could get an effective 20% tax deduction. Around 1 a.m. on December 20, 2017, Vice President Pence was in the chair if they needed his vote to break a tie in the Senate. It passed 51-48. A senior Democratic senator with whom Cohn was good friends came up to him. He seemed to be the most agitated person walking off the Senate floor. "This will do damage for the next decade," the senator said. "We'll be undoing this for the next decade." Cohn urged him to relax. "We had to get competitive in the corporate world," he said. "We just had to. And when you see that chart of our competitors, look, we're in a competitive world." The individual income tax rates were pegged at 10, 12, 22, 24, 32, 35, and the top rate, 37%. The drop from 39.6% was standard Republican tax cutting. In the end, the law would add an estimated $1.5 trillion to the annual deficit over 10 years. Republican leaders and Trump celebrated with self-congratulatory speeches on the south portico of the White House. Trump said, "Ultimately, what does it mean? It means jobs, jobs, jobs." Tax reform was the only major legislation passed his first year. Chapter 36. Early in 2018, the president unleashed a full takedown of Bannon, who had clearly spoken to journalist Michael Wolff as a main source for his unflattering book, Fire and Fury. In a long statement rather than a tweet, Trump said, "Steve Bannon has nothing to do with me or my presidency. When he was fired, he not only lost his job, he lost his mind. Now that he is on his own, Steve is learning that winning isn't as easy as I make it look." From his point of view, Bannon believed Trump had largely failed as a change agent. The old order in national security certainly won in Trump's first year, Bannon believed. Perhaps the only exception was a toughening stance on China and an awareness that China was the true rival in international affairs. Bannon was appalled by the National Security Strategy, a 55-page document published in December 2017. The Middle East section said the policy was designed to preserve a favorable regional balance of power. What the fuck is that? Bannon asked. It was a retread of the old-world Kissinger-esque order, seeking political stability. The whole purpose of Trump's 2017 Riyadh summit had been to form an alliance to shut down Iranian expansion and hegemony. Balance of power, in Bannon's view, meant the U.S. was comfortable with the status quo and Iran's short-of-war strategy that took confrontation to the brink but left Iran owning the gray zone. Bannon believed that Trump wanted to roll Iran back, get Iran out of Iraq, out of Syria, out of Lebanon, and out of the peninsula in Yemen. The alliance to do that was the U.S., Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and Israel. China was the real enemy. Russia was not the problem. The Russian economy was the size of New York State's economy, about $1.5 trillion, and the Chinese economy would soon be bigger than that of the United States, perhaps within a decade. Bannon still believed the forces of the populist nationalist movement were powerful. But the old order was able to blunt all that in the first year of the Trump presidency. The old order was not going to roll over. The populist movement had shown that it didn't have the force to break through the permanent political class. Trump had been the armor-piercing shell that could pierce the Clinton part, but not the rest. The Republican establishment had brought Trump to heel, he believed. The tax cut was a 100% corporate interest tax cut. The budget, adding $1.5 trillion to the deficit, was the worst part of the permanent political class boomtown mentality where every lobbyist got their deal for their clients. There was no wall. The swamp had won. The deep state was not the problem. It was the up-in-your-face state. Most compromising for Trump, in Bannon's view, was the January 26, 2018 speech that Trump gave at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. The New York Times headline had been, "Trump arrived in Davos as a party wrecker. He leaves praised as a pragmatist." It had been a Chamber of Commerce speech, Bannon believed. Trump had looked at the establishment and essentially embraced it. Trump's critique of Attorney General Jeff Sessions was particularly galling to Bannon. He was sure Trump would never get a better guy confirmed by the Senate. Grievance was a big part of Trump's core, very much like a 14-year-old boy who felt he was being picked on unfairly. You couldn't talk to him in adult logic. Teenage logic was necessary. During Trump's first 6 months in the White House, few understood how much media he consumed. It was scary. Trump didn't show up for work until 11 in the morning. Many times, he watched 6 to 8 hours of television in a day. "Think what your brain would be like if you did that," Bannon asked. Bannon claimed he used to say to Trump, "Cut the fucking thing off." At Mar-a-Lago, Trump would come back from playing golf. It'd be a Saturday afternoon in February or March. Absolutely stunningly beautiful. One of the most beautiful things in the world. Melania would be in the room right next door. He would watch CNN's D-team of panelists, whom Bannon considered super-haters, and get worked up. Bannon would say, "What are you doing? Why do you do this? Cut this off. It's not meaningful. Just enjoy yourself." Trump's response would often go like this. "You see that? That's a fucking lie. Who the fuck's..." Bannon would say, "Go play some slap and tickle with Melania." Trump also did not spend much time with his son Barron, then age 11. Bannon felt he was not friends with Trump. Trump didn't have genuine friends. He was a throwback to a different time, 1950s America. He was a man's man and a guy's guy. The hashtag Time's Up and hashtag Me Too movements of women and feminists would create an alternative to end the male-dominated patriarchy, Bannon believed. "Trump is the perfect foil," he summarized. "He's the bad father, the terrible first husband, the boyfriend that fucked you over and wasted all those years, and you gave up your youth for, and then dumped you. and the terrible boss that grabbed you by the pussy all the time and demeaned you. President Trump's tweets may have come close to starting a war with North Korea in early 2018. The public never learned the full story of the risks that Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un took as they engaged in a public battle of words. It began on New Year's Day in an address by Kim, reminding the world and the American president of his nuclear weapons. "It is not a mere threat, but a reality that I have a nuclear button on the desk in my office," Kim declared. "All of the mainland United States is within the range of our nuclear strike." It was an ugly and provocative threat. Lingering after receiving his president's daily briefing on January 2nd, President Trump said, "In this job, I'm playing five hands of poker simultaneously, and right now, we're winning most of the hands. Iran is busting up, and the regime is under intense pressure. Pakistan is terrified of losing all our security aid and reimbursements. And South Korea is going to capitulate to us on trade and talks with North Korea." He seemed on top of the world, but he didn't mention the fifth poker hand. Real power is fear. The answer on North Korea was to scare Kim Jong-un. "He's a bully," Trump told Porter. "He's a tough guy. The way to deal with those people is by being tough, and I'm going to intimidate him, and I'm going to outfox him." That evening, Trump sent a taunting, "Mine is bigger than yours" tweet that shook the White House and the diplomatic community. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un just stated that the nuclear button is on his desk at all times, Trump wrote on Twitter at 7:49 p.m. "Will someone from his depleted and food-starved regime please inform him that I, too, have a nuclear button, but it is a much bigger and more powerful one than his. And my button works." It played on Kim's insecurities. In the last 6 years, 18 of Kim's 86 missile tests had failed, according to the Center for Non-Proliferation Studies. The President of the United States was practicing a scene out of Dr. Strangelove. The Internet lost its collective mind. The Washington Post's Twitter account rushed to clarify, "There is no button." Colin Kahl, Obama's first Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, tweeted, "Folks aren't freaking out about a literal button. They are freaking out about the mental instability of a man who can kill millions without permission from anybody." Many on Twitter wondered if Trump had violated the platform's terms of service by threatening nuclear war. Others recalled Hillary Clinton's line from her July 2016 convention speech, "A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons." Trump's tweet was not without supporters. A writer for the conservative Washington Examiner concluded, "One of former President Barack Obama's central challenges was the foreign perception, by friends and foes alike, that he was reluctant to employ the full range of U.S. power. I believe Trump is right to roll the dice and take the opposite approach." Trump was not done, nor was he satisfied that it sufficed for the United States, the top nuclear power in the world, to issue an unprecedented threat. Within the White House, but not publicly, Trump proposed sending a tweet declaring that he was ordering all U.S. military dependents, thousands of the family members of 28,500 troops, out of South Korea. The act of removing the dependents would almost certainly be read in North Korea as a signal that the United States was seriously preparing for war. On December 4th, McMaster had received a warning at the White House. Ri Su-yong, the vice chairman of the Politburo, had told intermediaries that the North would take the evacuation of U.S. civilians as a sign of imminent attack. Withdrawing dependents was one of the last cards to play. The possible tweets scared the daylights out of the Pentagon leadership, Mattis and Dunford. A declaration of intent to do so from the U.S. commander-in-chief on Twitter was almost unthinkable. A tweet about ordering all military dependents out of South Korea could provoke Kim. The leader of a country like North Korea that only recently had acquired nuclear weapons and had many fewer nukes than a potential adversary could be trigger-happy. A use-it-or-lose-it mindset could take hold. The tweet did not go out. But Trump wouldn't drop the matter and raised the issue of withdrawing U.S. military dependence with Senator Graham. On December 3rd, before Trump and Kim's war of words and after a North Korean ICBM test, Graham had advocated removing military families from South Korea. "It's crazy to send spouses and children to South Korea," he said on CBS's Face the Nation. He suggested making South Korea an unaccompanied tour for service members and said, "I think it's now time to start moving American dependents out of South Korea." Now, a month later, when Trump called, Graham seemed to have had a change of heart. "You need to think long and hard before you make that decision," Graham said, "because when you make that decision, it is hard to go back. The day you do that is the day you rock the South Korean stock market and the Japanese economy. That is a big frigging deal." "You think I should wait?" Trump asked. "Mr. President," Graham said, "I don't think you should ever start this process unless you're ready to go to war." Trump had stayed his Twitter finger for the moment, but the issue of U.S. military dependence in South Korea did not go away. The U.S. military, however, continued to send dependents to South Korea. Chapter 37. General Kelly informed the president that his two top foreign policy advisors, McMaster and Tillerson, were in a ferocious fight over who would negotiate with Saudi Arabia to get $4 billion. The money was in part to fund operations in Syria, including a top-secret CIA project for the Syrian rebels, codenamed Teak. Getting foreign governments to fund U.S. military and CIA operations in foreign countries remained one of Trump's biggest goals. "Damn HR," Trump said. "This pointy-head academic has no sense of business or how to negotiate." Kelly agreed. McMaster was not the guy for the job and so far had not been very successful with the Saudis. They were often willing to write big checks for a variety of projects in Syria. According to Tillerson, McMaster had stepped in and said, "I'm reaching out to my counterparts in Saudi. I'm going to negotiate directly with them." The president was furious. Even with a multitude of problems with Tillerson, at least he had experience cutting deals with the Saudi royal family for years as the Exxon CEO. Tillerson also knew the Saudis could not be trusted, and for Trump, not trusting the people on the other side of the table was a first principle of haggling, of beating them down to get a better bargain. You had to be tough and say no to get yes. Why the hell would McMaster take this away from Tillerson? "It doesn't make any sense," he said. But there was a more pressing matter that day, January 19, 2018, one day short of Trump's first full year. In several secure phone conversations with President Moon Jae-in of South Korea, Trump had intensified his criticism of the CORUS trade agreement between the two countries. He would not let go of the $18 billion trade deficit and the $3.5 billion expense of stationing 28,500 U.S. troops. The refrain was jeopardizing relations with Moon, whom he disliked. Trump's obsessive and unfiltered venting had brought him to the edge once again. Trump told Moon he wanted to send a 180-day termination letter and destroy the trade relationship. "You guys are ripping us off," he said. He wanted the trade and security issues separated. "I'm done just giving you guys free money." Moon replied that trade and security were intertwined. "We want to work with you," the South Korean president said. He was conciliatory. "You're one of our allies, one of our partners. There may be some misunderstanding about the economic relationship. We want to come to an understanding." Trump was amped up. "You've got to pay for the THAAD anti-ballistic missile system. Why do we need to have any of our anti-ballistic system there?" He belittled the CORUS trade agreement South Korea, and its new leader. This barely concealed rage at an ally was magnificently undiplomatic, the way the president often liked it. He was on the verge of blowing up the relationship. Kelly, McMaster, Tillerson, and Mattis joked darkly that it was inexplicable that the president was voicing more ire at South Korea than our adversaries, China, Russia, Iran, Syria, and North Korea. The senior White House staff and national security team were appalled. They didn't know what the president might say or do. This was an important relationship, especially at that moment. They had to shut this down. There was a consensus that something needed to be done before Moon decided he'd had enough. McMaster set up a National Security Council meeting in the Situation Room for January 19, 2018. The meeting was billed as a discussion of issues related to South Korea among the president and the principals, Tillerson, Mattis, Kelly, McMaster, Dunford, Cohn. Trump got right to his point. "What do we get by maintaining a massive military presence in the Korean Peninsula?" he asked, returning to his obsession with the money and the troops. "And even more than that," he went on, "what do we get from protecting Taiwan, say?" He had always seen this as a worldwide problem. The United States paying for the defense of others in Asia, the Middle East, and NATO. "Why are we even friends with South Korea?" he wanted to know. "What do we get out of this?" He had been fuming for a year. The answers were insufficient. Mattis and General Dunford once more explained the benefit was immense. "We get a stable democracy in a part of the world where we really need it," Mattis said. "South Korea was one of the strongest bastions, free elections, and a vibrant capitalism." South Korea had a population of 50 million people, the 27th largest country in the world, but with an economy that was the 11th largest and a GDP of $1.5 trillion, the same as Russia's. Trump had been informed about the EDGE, the Special Access Program intelligence operations gave the United States in detecting a North Korean missile launch, 7 seconds versus 15 minutes from Alaska. There was also an offensive cyber attack capability. It had mixed results, sabotaging North Korean missiles before or after launch. Mattis showed signs that he was tired of the disparaging of the military and intelligence capability, and of Trump's unwillingness to comprehend their significance. "We're doing this in order to prevent World War III," Mattis said. He was calm but stark. It was a breathtaking statement, a challenge to the president, suggesting he was risking nuclear war. Time stopped for more than one in attendance. One person present said Mattis's message was clear. "Stop fucking around with this. We're doing this because we've got to prevent World War III. This isn't some business gamble where if you happen to go bankrupt or whatever, it's not a big deal." It seemed Mattis and others were at the end of their rope with the president. "How are you possibly questioning these things that are obvious and so fundamental?" It was as if Mattis were saying, "God, stop it." Mattis was not finished. "We have the ability to defend the homeland with forward deployment of the 28,500 troops." He was reluctant to mention the special access programs in such a large meeting. Mattis explained, "Without the intelligence capability and the troops, the risk of war would vastly increase. The means of defending South Korea and Japan would be decreased. If there was a war without these assets, the only option left is the nuclear option. We can't achieve the same deterrent effect in any other way, and we can't do it as cost-effectively." The arrangement with South Korea was one of the great national security bargains of all time. Mattis tried to speak the president's language of cost-benefit analysis. "But we're losing so much money in trade with South Korea, China, and others," Trump countered. "I'd rather be spending money on our own country." The United States was subsidizing others with the trade imbalances. Other countries, Trump went on, who've agreed to do security things for us, only do it because they're taking so much of our money. They were almost stealing from us. Forward-positioned troops provide the least costly means of achieving our security objectives, and withdrawal could lead our allies to lose all confidence in us, Mattis replied. Chairman Dunford stepped in, seconding all these points with some passion. We're spending massive amounts for very rich countries who aren't burden-sharing, Trump said, hammering his point. Then, out of the blue, he raised what Kelly had told him about the McMaster and Tillerson feud over who would negotiate with the Saudis to get the $4 billion for operations in Syria and elsewhere. He said he had heard McMaster had urged Tillerson to back off. He laid into his national security adviser. Why would you do that? He asked McMaster. The Saudis are confused. This is $4 billion. Rex is going to do this. HR, stay out of it. I have no idea why you possibly would have thought that it was wise for you to take it away from Rex, but steer clear. Rex is going to do this. He's going to handle it. McMaster took the dressing down in stride. He had been insulted in front of the National Security Council he was supposed to lead and coordinate. McMaster, a chain of command general, replied, Yes, sir. Tillerson, on the other hand, turned back to the main issue, the value of forward deployment. It's the best model, the global system. Joining together in trade and geopolitics leads to good security outcomes. Dunford again supported his argument. Our forward deployed cost in South Korea is roughly $2 billion. South Korea reimburses us for over $800 million of that. We don't seek reimbursement for the cost of our troops, such as their pay. The chairman also said that other countries were paying the U.S. an annual subsidy for activities we would engage in anyway for our own protection. We're getting $4 billion a year subsidy in our efforts to protect the homeland, Dunford said. I think we could be so rich, Trump said, if we weren't stupid. We're being played as suckers, especially NATO. Collective defense was a sucker play. Citing a number often used by Bannon for the financial sacrifice and cost of all the wars, military presence, and foreign aid in the Middle East, the president summed up, We have spent $7 trillion in the Middle East. We can't even muster $1 trillion for domestic infrastructure. The president left. Among the principals, there was exasperation with these questions. Why are we having to do this constantly? When is he going to learn? They couldn't believe they were having these conversations and had to justify their reasoning. Mattis was particularly exasperated and alarmed, telling close associates that the president acted like and had the understanding of a fifth or sixth grader. When I first learned of the details of this NSC meeting, I went back to a transcript of what President Obama had told me in 2010 about what he worried about the most. A potential game changer, Obama said, would be a nuclear weapon blowing up a major American city. And so when I go down the list of things I have to worry about all the time, that is at the top, because that's one area where you can't afford any mistakes. And right away, coming in, we said, how are we going to start ramping up and putting that at the center of a lot of our national security discussion? Make sure that that occurrence, even if remote, never happens. The pressure campaign on North Korea was effectively put on hold while the 2018 Winter Olympics were held in South Korea from February 9th to the 25th. General Dunford learned that the Air Force had planned some research and design tests of its nuclear-capable ballistic missiles from California into the Pacific Ocean, scheduled right before and after the Olympics. They were the kind of tests that the United States was pressuring North Korea to stop. They were provocative. He stepped in, and the Air Force held off on the tests. Early in 2018, the CIA concluded that North Korea did not have the capability to accurately deliver a missile into the United States mainland with a nuclear weapon on top. According to the intelligence and the information on the testing of North Korean rockets, they did not have the reentry of missiles perfected. But they were marching toward that goal. The CIA, for the moment, seemed to convince Trump that the North was not yet there. Chapter 38. Afghanistan continued to frustrate Trump. Months earlier, in late September, he had hosted a reception at the United Nations annual meeting in New York. Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev and his wife posed for a picture with the Trumps. The Azerbaijan leader passed word that the Chinese were mining substantial amounts of copper from Afghanistan. Trump was furious. Here was the United States paying billions for the war, and China was stealing copper. Afghan President Ghani had dangled the possibility that the United States would have exclusive access to vast mineral wealth untouched in the Afghanistan mountain ranges. His argument? There's so much money to be made. Don't walk away. Rare earth minerals, including lithium, a main ingredient in the latest batteries. Some exaggerated estimates held that all minerals in Afghanistan might be worth as much as several trillion dollars. Trump wanted the minerals. "They have offered us their minerals," he said at one meeting. "Offered us everything. Why aren't we there taking them? You guys are sitting on your ass. The Chinese are raiding the place." "Sir," said Gary Cohn, "it's not like we just walk in there and take the minerals. They have no legal system, no land rights. It would cost billions of dollars to build the mining infrastructure," he added. "We need to get a company in there," Trump said. "Put it out for bid." This was a giant opportunity. Capitalism, building and development at its best. "Why aren't we in there taking it?" "Who's we?" Cohn asked. "We should just be in there taking it," Trump said, as if there were a national mining company to move into Afghanistan. At a subsequent meeting in the Oval Office, Trump asked, "Why hasn't this been done?" "We're running it through the NSC process," McMaster said. "I don't need it done through a fucking process," Trump yelled. "I need you guys to go in there and get this stuff. It's free. Who wants to do this?" It was a free-for-all. Who wanted this bonanza? Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross volunteered. "I'll take care of it, sir. I'll do it," he said, as if it were a Commerce Department issue. Trump approved. Kelly didn't say much, but took McMaster, Ross, and Cohn to his office. McMaster was rip-shit at Kelly for not intervening. "You just chopped my legs out from me. You knew I was running a process." He was going by the textbook as usual, was working with the state and defense departments and any other departments or agencies with an interest. "You hung me out to dry in front of the president." There was little that appealed to Trump more than the idea of getting money from others to pay for national security commitments made by previous U.S. administrations, NATO, Afghanistan, Iraq. The only other appealing prospect was making a good deal, and he thought this was one. The State Department assessed the mineral rights. Analysts concluded this would be a great propaganda boon to worldwide extremists. "The United States is coming to rape your land and steal your wealth from the ground." They sought legal opinions in hopes of slowing it down. On February 7, 2018, McMaster convened a small group of principals in the Situation Room to hear Commerce Secretary Ross's report. He had talked with the acting Minister of Mining in Afghanistan that morning. "The Chinese are not getting anything out. They have these big concessions, as they do worldwide, and they sit on them. They're in it for the long term. They don't need to make immediate money off it." So there was nothing to worry about. Afghanistan did not have the infrastructure or transportation, the regulatory or environmental controls, he said. No private company would make an investment. "It's fake news," Ross said, to mild laughter. McMaster added that most of these minerals would be impossible to reach because a lot of them were in Taliban-controlled areas. It was a war zone, and a military perimeter defense would have to be established before mining. At best, he said, it would take 10 years if everything went right. Ross said he would follow up to explain this to the president. Kelly seemed to be just trying to keep the ship from sinking. At a senior staff meeting in early 2018, he announced with pride, "I now know that I will not be the shortest-serving chief of staff. I've now surpassed Reince." Priebus had served 189 days, the shortest tenure of any White House chief of staff in history. Early in 2018, 60 Minutes broadcast a piece on the Afghanistan war, noting that Kabul was so violent that the U.S. commander could not be safely driven to his headquarters through the city. General Nicholson flew the 2 miles by helicopter. He made it clear he had adopted Trump's victory-driven approach. "This is a policy that can deliver a win," Nicholson said. Nicholson's intelligence and operational maps showed that the U.S.-led coalition controlled about 50% of the country. Within knowledgeable Pentagon and State Department circles, it was known that Nicholson had claimed, "I'll get to 80% in 2 years." He was determined to enhance the coalition's and Afghan Army's capability to claw back what would amount to 75,000 square miles. It was unattainable, even preposterous, to many who had served in Afghanistan. A secondary goal of Nicholson's was that after 4 years, the Taliban would realize they could not win and would come to the negotiating table. This was the same Taliban that had been fighting for 16 years. The DNI intelligence expert briefed Trump on Afghanistan in early 2018. No gains by the U.S. in territory. Nothing clawed back. No improvement from last year. Actually, some areas were getting worse. Part of the explanation was that the U.S. and Afghans had to guard Kabul as the Taliban mounted attack after attack on the capital. In the last 9 days of January, 130 people were killed in 4 attacks. This left little coalition military capacity to take back territory. The analysts had more grim conclusions. Pakistan was not playing ball or responding to pressure. Any settlement was premised on Pakistani participation. The immediate prospect was more insurgency, maybe even civil war, if the U.S. pulled out. Jihadists were coming out of Syria and heading to Afghanistan, the new promised land for bomb makers and bomb throwers. The coalition probably only had until the spring of 2019 to keep the status quo. The political fabric seemed to be coming apart. A perfect storm was coming, and a practical problem like weather might be the tipping point. The mountains had little to no snow, so no water was coming down to the fields. A drought was coming, and with it, a crisis of food insecurity. Around the same time, Pakistan was likely to send 1 to 2 million refugees over the border into Afghanistan, many of them Afghans who had crossed the border into Pakistan after the Russian invasion of 1979. Some 2 million had lived in Pakistan for decades, never in their native Afghanistan, but they would be coming. Still, General Nicholson kept saying that he would win in Afghanistan. Mattis didn't like it. "The secretary is very unhappy with what he," Nicholson, "just said, and we're trying to rein him in," one Pentagon official privately confided. If the language of the commander-in-chief was about winning, it was hard to criticize the ground commander for using it. But the intelligence indicated that it was heading to worse, not better, next year. In early 2018, one key participant said, "The military seemed to want a South Korea-style permanent presence. If so, Iran, Russia, and China will ramp up their antagonism because all of a sudden, we now have a permanent presence in their backyard. But the military may have got its way here because getting out would be a huge walkdown. The president said we're going to win, and you can't define that as stalemate forever. At some point, People are going to recognize you can't succeed there. Quietly and nervously, some officials at state and the intelligence community began some extremely sensitive scenario planning, a Plan B. The military does scenario planning all the time. Why not the civilians? The analyst described the outcome of this Plan B. It's not a withdrawal and a collapse and civil war. It's not a liberal democracy deeply centralized. What's in the middle? Federalist, more realistic, more sustainable, to give potentially the Taliban a role. The sort of wild card is the president's short attention span and his questioning all these assumptions that people keep throwing out, and smelling and calling bullshit when he sees it. For example, saying things will work out with Pakistan. But Pakistan has not changed since 9/11, and they won't. The only option, then, is to get out. In summary, Afghanistan was a new house of broken toys. Political instability, fraying of the Afghan government, congressional and public criticism in the United States, few, if any, military gains, drought, massive food insecurity, refugees. Trump blamed two people in particular. First, he had a special scorn for former President George W. Bush, who had started the Afghanistan War in 2001 and then the Iraq War in 2003. A terrible president, he told Porter. He was a warmonger. He wanted to exert American influence and take democracy all throughout the world, and wanted to be the world's policeman and started all these wars. It was foolhardy and a mistake. Even though Trump had made the decision to add several thousand troops, he said he was not going to continue the status quo. The other person Trump blamed was McMaster. He used Iraq as evidence. I don't know how they've, the Iraqis, managed to fool McMaster, but he's not a businessman. They, U.S. generals, don't understand the cost-benefit analysis. I can't believe I let him talk me into putting more troops in there. He believed that McMaster had been co-opted. In a searing insult to McMaster, Trump did an imitation of his national security advisor. The president puffed up his chest and started noticeably exaggerated breathing. He said in loud staccato, "I know the president of Iraq. He's a good man, sir. I know he has our best interest at heart." Returning to his normal voice, Trump said, "That guy's just full of shit. I met this guy. McMaster doesn't know what he's talking about." Trump had met the Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi at the White House in March 2017. "These military guys, they don't get business. They know how to be soldiers and they know how to fight. They don't understand how much it's costing." On Afghanistan, Trump told Porter, "It's a disaster there. It's never going to be a functioning democracy. We ought to just exit completely." Chapter 39. Trump and Senator Graham played golf at the Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach 2 weeks before Christmas, December 10th, 2017. In a tweet, Graham said the golf course was spectacular, a comment sure to please Trump. It was nothing compared to the praise Graham lavished on Trump during their round. "You're a very good commander-in-chief," he told Trump. The president was listening to his military commanders, and the changes in the rules of engagement in the Middle East and Afghanistan were paying off. This was Graham's pitch to Trump. "You can do something nobody else did. You're cleaning up the mess that Obama left you. You're doing a damn good job of cleaning it up. You're rebuilding the military. You're taking a wet blanket off the economy. You're really unshackling the military and the economy. God bless you for undoing the damage done in the last 8 years. Where do you want to go? What do you want to be your legacy? Your legacy is not just undoing what he did, but it's putting your stamp on history." Trump seemed to love the adulation, but said to Graham, "You're a middle-of-the-road guy. I want you to be 100% for Trump. This resembled the loyalty pledge that then FBI Director James Comey said that Trump had asked of him. According to Comey, Trump had said, "I need loyalty. I expect loyalty," during their now famous one-on-one green room dinner in the White House during the first week of the Trump presidency. "Okay, what's the issue?" Graham asked, "and I'll tell you whether I'm 100% for you or not." "You're like 82%, Trump said. "Well, some days I'm 100%, some days I may be zero." "I want you to be a 100% guy." "Why would you want me to tell you you're right when I think you're wrong? What good does that do for you or me?" Graham asked. "Presidents need people that can tell them the truth as they see it. It's up to you to see if I'm full of shit." On December 29, 2017, Trump's tweet had summarized his position on DACA. "The Democrats have been told and fully understand that there can be no DACA without the desperately needed wall at the southern border and an end to the horrible chain migration. We must protect our country at all cost." The president called a meeting in the cabinet room with 20 senators and House members to discuss an immigration plan for the Dreamers. Trump directed that the Tuesday, January 9th meeting be televised, all 55 minutes. He was in full performance mode, promising legislation. "Truly, it should be a bill of love, and we can do that." The president was engaging and fun. Graham was astounded at Trump's apparent shift on one of the most polarizing issues before them. The anti-immigration hardliners would be aghast. Trump had once been their leader. Graham hoped this was the president at his deal-making best. Graham had never felt better about Trump's ability to get an immigration deal done. He had worked on immigration for years, attempting to broker compromises with Democrats like Ted Kennedy, Chuck Schumer, and Dick Durbin. With Trump, he saw the potential to finally succeed. In a statement, he was exuberant, saying, "Most fascinating meeting I've been involved with in 20-plus years in politics." The headlines reinforced Graham's optimism. The New York Times: "Trump appears to endorse path to citizenship for millions of immigrants." The Washington Post: "At the table, Trump tried to negotiate and prove stability." The next day, Trump phoned Graham. "I thought you were masterful," Graham said. "Don't let all these people, Republican hardliners, scare you away. You're on track here. This is the guy that I try to tell people about when we play golf. This is the Donald Trump that I'm all in for. Only you can do it. Bush tried. Obama couldn't do it. You can do this." To Graham's surprise, Trump put Melania, the First Lady, on the phone. "I just wanted to tell you I like what you said," the First Lady said in her soft accent, "and the way you handled yourself, and the way you speak. I thought it was very nice." "Well, thank you, ma'am. You made my day," Graham replied. He was impressed with her grace. It was the first time he had ever really talked to her. It was pretty clear she, an immigrant herself, was sympathetic to the DACA children. "Can we change the libel laws?" Trump asked, rapidly shifting the tenor of the conversation to one of his pet peeves. "No," Graham, the lawyer, said. "Why?" "We are not England," Graham said, "where the libel laws were stricter." "People were writing bullshit," Trump said. "I don't doubt it," Graham agreed. "But no, we can't change the libel laws, and don't worry about it." In the landmark 1964 decision New York Times v. Sullivan, the U.S. Supreme Court had set the libel bar about as high as possible. Something was libelous only if published or said, knowing that it was false and with reckless disregard for the truth. "Well, I don't intend to become like England," Trump said. "There's no more bigger punching bag in all the world than the President of the United States," Graham said. "And you've gotten more than your fair share of unfounded criticism, but that's just the hand you're dealt. And the way you beat them, Mr. President, is you produce. And the way you put your critics in a box is you don't sue them, you just deliver. Prove all these guys wrong. Graham felt it had been one of his best conversations with the president. He had done most of the talking.